another 666 ABC Canberra podcast. To subscribe to any of our podcasts, go to abc.net.au/Canberra.
Rare Collections.
Hi, this is Geordie Kilby, and thanks for tuning in for another issue of Rare Collections. This week, a bit of a special treat for you. Recently, we covered jazz rock in Australia. One of the interviews we did for that program was with drummer Warren Daly, a key part of the massive Daly Wilson Big Band. And it was such a great interview. Warren had so many interesting stories to share. We thought we'd share it with you. So for the last Rare Collections for this year, here's the interview that we did recently with Warren Daly. The Ramblers, what brought you all together? Were you sort of high school band?
No, it was a meeting of people at the church. We went to fellowship, you know, for the opportunity to meet young girls, of course, and I was playing my drums. It was January 1958, and I'd met up with Max Hamilton, the guitarist, who was a neighbour and also a former schoolmate of mine, and we went down to play at the Fellowship Dance as a duet. It was a trio. In fact, there was a pianist as well. But one of the young lads, Kevin Booth, got up and did the best impersonation of Jerry Lee Lewis we'd ever heard. And we thought, okay, you'll do. You're in. So that was about when it was formed with the three of us, Kevin Booth, Max Hamilton, and myself. And it was my band, The Ramblers, you know.
Okay, and so you were all very much inspired by the rock and roll sounds of that time?
Absolutely, but always behind that, there was a wish to play jazz and big band music. So there was probably the biggest love I had was to want to play in a big band even then. But
what gave you that? Why did you have that love that earlier on, and particularly in that era then?
Warren? I guess because being the younger brother of three of us, I was the youngest. My older brother was listening to Howard Craven's Rumpus Room, and Les Elgart's big band had a theme of For Dancers Only. And so before even rock and roll started, I'd been weaned, so to speak, on hearing things from the Glenn Miller band, Gene Krupa, Les Elgart, and the like. You know.
Right. Still, January 1958's still pretty early in the rock and roll scene in Australia too, isn't it?
It was. We were one of a number of early bands that started up, and we had just the most amazing time. It was just so good, the fellowship in that group, as it expanded to and added more personnel and changed personnel, ultimately in 1960 becoming renamed The Steeds.
What drove you to change the name then to The Steeds, and what happened when The Steeds began?
Well, you had to have, as they always say today, and you had to have some angle, some gimmick. And we had a particularly good-looking male singer that looked like Crash Craddock. and Crash was very hot at the time with Boom Boom Baby. And along came this fellow, David Johnston, who suggested, look, you ought to cash in on the fact that this guy looks like a little bit of a, how can I put it, a stallion. And so he was Rod Stallion and we were the Steeds. So we were renamed. And it kind of worked with the girls, I tell you.
What about the difference in music then that you were playing between the Ramblers and the Steeds?
Well, I guess we virtually changed some of the vocals to suit Rod's style, which was more along the lines of Cliff Richard. Yeah, he did a lot of sounds like that. We also maintained the Jerry Lee Lewis and all the other, right, you know, out there vocals with guest singers that came along as well. So we virtually still embraced the whole, 10 yards of what was on and being played at the time. We had, at that time, Frank West had come in on saxophone in 1959, and we had Billy Gerhardt, alias Billy G, come in on guitar, and Len Farrell on bass, and myself on drums, and Rod Stallion, a.k.a. Stevens was his real name. He stayed for a while, but essentially in 1960, he left not long after, and we carried on as a quartet, you know.
Okay. And were you writing much original material then at all, or was it all covers?
It was pretty much all covers. We did Roadrunner, which was an original, but pretty much everything else we did were based on covers, you know.
Okay. So Roadrunner is a single that, we have a copy of on Parlophone, I think it
Parlophone,
was.
Yep.
I'm surprised you were able to find one.
It didn't sell that well then, Warren.
No, it didn't, but I can assure you it's musically challenging, especially for me as a drummer, I kind of like it. It was a bit of a fun thing based on the cartoon that was very popular at the time, as you would remember, you know, the Mad Coyote, the Roadrunner.
So were there times then going through that Ramblers, the Steeds and the single not selling and so on when Warren Daly thought, oh, the heck with this, I'm going to get a real job?
No, never. In fact, that's just one part of it. You see, we were the most successful backing band for all the big concerts, and so we didn't need to have hit records to survive because we could all read, which was unusual for those days.
Sure.
And so we used to back all the major acts at the Trocadero dance, and
like
used to, I'll just say 2,000 people used to turn up every Saturday afternoon, Coca-Cola bottlers dances, and we would have the Allen Brothers, Johnny Reb, Lonnie nice. Lee, Johnny Devlin, the Deltones, Lee Sellers, Jay Justin, I'm just trying to think now. If I didn't say the DeCrew brothers, certainly we backed them. We just backed everybody. And so we were working constantly. It was never a case of wanting a real job. In fact, I left my real job to become full-time in 1961, and I was making four times as much and continued to do so as I had been in my real job. I was a publicity assistant at Wunderlich Limited, the building material company.
Sure.
Yeah, and I used to work for a deaf boss, and he had to lip read, and I used to answer the phones and do publicity errands and the like in there. I loved the job. It was great, but trying to work a rock and roll career as well was starting to wear me down. I still have my resignation letter, which is very comical.
Just given the spread of artists then that you backed, were you ever daunted by what you had to play and what you were asked to play?
Never with the rock and roll stuff, because we could read, we could play our instruments well. And the only time that I ever was daunted was we were hired to play for a musical, so to speak, at the Elizabethan Theatre, which had ceased to become active as it was with J.C. Williamson. So they renamed it the Un-Elizabethan Theatre. And in we went with a cast of about 60 people, dancers, and a lot of people known at the time. And we were presented with our quartet, a record that was a full orchestra. And they said, play this, will you? And that really was daunting. But I tell you what, we made a fist of it. But it was, what was it called now? Melody something or other. Bobo Faulkner was in it, and Peggy Watson dances. Gosh. And gee, there are a lot of people in it. Oh, yeah, Sandy Scott was in it. Melody something or other, I can't remember. I've got the brochure at home, though. I could look it up when I go home, yeah.
So did that session work that you were talking about sort of carry you through most of the 60s then, up until the formation of the big band? Or
yes, in fact, just looking at the Steeds, I was with the Ramblers, 58, 59, to 60, 60 to 64 with the Steeds when we released Roadrunner, Mama Inez on the back as the B-side. And then in 64, I went to Romano's with the nightclub, working six nights a week and playing with big bands earlier than that, back in 61, I must say, and Billy Weston's big band, then to Spelson's in 65,
oh, gosh.
And then to Bill Barrett's big band two nights a week, then from Bill Barrett's big band to staff drummer at Channel 10 with Jack Grimsley, with the orchestra, 66 and all that, the Barry Crocker show, you know, the Brian Adams show, the Hazel Phillips show. We did so many different varietal shows, and then, of course, in and around all of that were all of the commercials and recordings. I'd forgotten that I recorded a Bee Gees album, you know, I'd forgotten it. And we were doing stuff with O'Keefe, some of his stuff. We did the Johnny O'Keefe show in 67 at Channel 10, and a host of imported artists, including the Mills Brothers, you know, just so many great acts that were coming out. The Kirby Stone 4 came out.
Yes.
And asked me if I'd join them in America, and so I thought about all the sessions I was doing, and I said, do you really enjoy doing these sessions? And I said, no, I want to go and play with an American big band. And so I said to Kirby, look, I'm going to be honest, I'd love to come with you, and I'm honoured. But I said, ultimately, my heartfelt dream is to play with a big band. He said, come with us. And so I went and played with them at the Moon Supper Club in Detroit, the London House in Chicago, in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace when it was brand new. And the Las Vegas was just a delight then. Across the road, you'd see Duke Ellington, you know. Down the way a bit, you'd see Helen O'Connell with the Cy Zentner band. Guess what? I went up and talked to Cy, and I said, I'm just over here from studio work. I'd love to play in a big band. He said, I'll come and listen. I got the job.
So, did you really?
Yeah, and next minute I'm playing on the road with Cy Zentner's big band.
Gosh, we collect Cy Zentner records.
Do you?
Yeah, my word. Yeah.
Look, he used to be the lead trombonist with the MGM Orchestra. He had sensational chops, as we say, you know, and he could outblow a raging nine-piece brass section, five saxons, four-rhythm big band, standing up the back with no mic. He was a bull, and what a great player. And he had a worldwide hit with Up a Lazy River.
Yeah.
He was best known probably for his very sweet playing, a la Dorsey in a way, but in another way, nothing like Tommy. But I then found
and he
that...
he kept a big band going for a long time, didn't he?
Cy did, yes, yeah. He certainly did. And a very fine band, great brass section, really, and I just loved it. And Billy May came in, and of course Billy and Cy used to work together such a lot. And I said, having been asked so often in Australia by the brass players who were 15 years older than me, you're too loud, you know. Syke said to me after Billy came in and heard the band, he said, Billy said, you sound great, but you could play harder, which was a delight. So I started playing much harder, and that suited me just fine, more like back in the Steeds, if you know what I mean. And having said that, I found the band was in a layoff because there were a lot of summer riots, and unfortunately Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, and we were to go with the Cy Zentner band and play a fundraiser in New York the very next night. Right. And we never got to go because of that. That job was cancelled, but we went on and played, you know, beyond those dates. But then we laid off from touring because of the riots on the, you know, and so Cy didn't want to be but relocated back at the Tropicana, where he was pretty much resident band leader when it suited him. And anyway, at the Blue Room, by the way. And so I got a call from the Buddy DeFranco to join the Glenn Miller band. And Buddy is, you know, he's won Downbeat at that time 16 years in a row as the best jazz clarinetist. And what a delight that was. So we did 38 states of America, and we toured Japan and Korea. And I left that band after playing in the officer's mess at the Air Force Base. I think it's Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor. And that was the last date I did. Went back and formed the Daily Wilson Band.
Wow. So you came back knowing that you were going to form something like that then? Or
yes, because Ed Wilson had come over in the Canberra with Ron Nann, one of our friends, a saxophonist. And Ed and I had already tried in 65... This is 1968, mind you, and that I'm referring to presently, but in 65 we'd tried and put together a young band, but the young players weren't available with the technique to master the difficult charts that we wanted to play.
Okay.
And so young guys in the studios were quite you know, rare. There were about five of us: Graham Lyle, Ed Wilson, myself, Steve Powell, Bob McIver, Ned Sutherland, and I think I've stopped, you know, of the young guys, you know. So you couldn't form a big band way back then. But 68 saw a change, and he came over in the Canberra with Ronnie and met me at Las Vegas and said, I think it's going to be right, you know, when you come back, I think we can do it. So, you know, I formed one half of the band, he formed the other. This is Ed Wilson I'm speaking of, and as soon as we came back, straight into it, we wrote the first chart for the band in December 68, WDNHO Blues, and it was titled that because it was a double entendre. It was Warren Daly and his own blues, but it was also intended to attract a sponsor, which we got later.
Yeah, different and, brand.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was the parent company, WDNHO Blues, for Benson and Hedges, who ultimately sponsored us. Sounds like a plot, doesn't it?
It does sound like it. And was it instantly successful, Warren?
Yes. Look, we were an underground band, but it came from my experience in America and also the inner inferno of youth, that we were tired of playing sedately as the bands were expected to play, and we just wanted to turn it on its head. And Blood, Sweat and Tears had just come in, and we thought, wow, let's just go for this. And the band attracted a huge lot of attention, and we wouldn't let anyone come to rehearsals, and we rehearsed the band for 8 months, and the band was on fire when we opened our first concert at the stage club where we'd been rehearsing. And it was at 2 a.m. and the queue outside, you couldn't get in. The roundhouse was packed at New South Wales Uni, musicians club in Chalmers Street. They were falling out the windows. I mean, they'd never heard anything like this. No. Because we actually came in sounding like we were bold, excited and determined. We were playing the Buddy Rich arrangements, our own arrangements, but we played it like we were going to set the world on fire. I say that because we were a bunch of maniacs, and one of the Telegraph, journalists described our first recorded effort as the reincarnation of the John Kennedy assassination. But that was being unkind. We were capable of playing very sedately, as you would hear on our first album, with that Cole Loughlin doing that remarkably fine job on tenor saxophone, All the Things You Are, the Jerome Kern jewel. It's just magnificent. So the band did have its energy, but it also knew how to do the other, you know.
Right across the career of the band is that the range of songs that you played within it were, you know, some are jazz classics like the one you show tunes, Rolf Harris songs. There's a really, really big variety of material that you turned your heads to.
Yes, we wanted to try and knock down all barriers. I mean, there had been such a barrier to progress laid down by the belief that you had to be cool when you played big band music. We wanted to be open, you know, lay yourself bare and play all the things that meant something to you and the new and young people. And so we started playing all of the rock things, the jazz rock things and the jazz things. We kept all the jazz things in, and the people loved it. I think the secret to the band's success was excitement was the most important thing to us. If it wasn't exciting, we didn't play it. If we didn't play exciting in an exciting way, then we'd failed. And that really transmitted to the audience. we used to frighten the hell out of them. We would sneak in with a blues, and it would be, and yet they'd get into the mood of the super soft groove, and then the brass section would come in, pow! You'd see them in the front row being stretched out with a heart attack. Funny story, I must tell you. In 71, we were the act chosen to play opposite Dudley Moore and his trio, and I was quick enough to get in to the State Theatre and pre-book the use of the organ that went up and down. And so there's this 2,000-seat theatre packed to the rafters, and Col Nolan on electric organ does exactly what I just described, and he's coming up and down in this Hammond organ, playing away. And then as we'd go a bit further through the tune, he'd go down again and he'd be yelling out, "Help!" You know? And Dudley Moore was filthy that he hadn't got in first to do it. Brought the house down, you know. That was WDNHO Blues, as I mentioned. And you know what? They run that, or did run it, by utilisation of water from Glebe, the Glebe station. And really? So they rang up and said, because we kept going up and down so much, they said, "We can't keep this up. You can't keep doing that." They rang up the backstage manager.
Were they concert performances, Warren, or was it dancing stuff too?
No, we specialised in concert performances, and did so for a great many years. We played 58 concerts in 3 years, which you might think isn't a lot, but they were always fully attended, you know, except when the Pope was in town. I think we had a small house that night. But no, I mean that sincerely. That was one that we didn't do so well. And but every other concert we put on was packed. We backed Cilla Black on tour. We backed Sammy Davis Jr. Later on, we backed Frank Sinatra when he returned in 74, the old Blue Eyes tour. We were selected by Sonny Burke, his great producer, who did so many of his great records, including Basie at the Sands with Sinatra. Sonny absolutely loved our band and used to take our records to sessions in Hollywood and put them on the turntable, would you believe this, and say, "This is how I want you to play."
Really?
Yeah, Frank Sinatra Jr. told me that, Frank Sr.'s son. And anyway, that's how we got the appointment to back Frank on his return with his old Blue Eyes tour after he came out of retirement. That's the Sensational Eyes tour where he called journalists, women in particular, an unkind... he described them unkindly. That'll do.
That's right. What was his reaction to your band then, Warren?
Oh, look, as much as you would have heard that Cranky Frankie and the like, thorough gentleman, loved our band, loved it, and said so. And it's just such a delight to work with such a giant of a talent. When they call him the chairman of the board, it's true. Whenever he performed anywhere in a session, the musicians in America, wherever he was, would take cameras in to take pictures of him. You know, that's how highly he was regarded.
The concerts were all proving really successful. Everywhere you played, you were having sell-out houses, and yet after a couple of albums, it became too difficult to keep the band together. Is that...
It's an irony of life that whatever you try and do, people will try and stop you. And the Musicians Union was terrified of Daly Wilson Big Band because they thought our objective was to take all the session work off the older trumpet players, trombonists, saxophonists, etc. And that was never our aim. All we wanted to do was have an American-style road band, concert band. And we had comments come back to us, before you know it, Daly Wilson will be running this town. And that was because our trumpet players and trombonists, and generally all the players, were developing such a standard that they were concerned. And ultimately, I had to get on the union committee to keep them quiet. Anyway, you schemer, Warren. Anyway, it worked, and they left us alone. But ultimately, we realised that unless we were going to be able to attract a sponsor and get some money in, we were never going to go anywhere but fade, because you can't do well if you don't expand. And we needed some backing. And so I suggested to the partners, Ed and Don Rabbity, who was the lead trumpet player, a later included partner, in terms of the earliest days, I should say, I said, look, we should just wrap this because we're going nowhere and we may get a sponsor. And so we went out with a big bang, an hour special recorded and televised with an outside broadcast from the Cremorne Orpheum Theatre, 1,600 people, and it was a real big bang and a lot of good publicity for us. And the stuff that was written about it was blowing hard in the wind in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it attracted a lot of attention. Now, wait for this. One of our friends, not a player that was in the band, but was one of our friends that we grew up with playing jazz sessions in people's lounge rooms, Dennis Langley, worked for Benson and Hedges, and they were looking for something to celebrate their centenary. And he said, would you believe they've recorded WDNHO Blues? That's one thing, but the public really want this band, and it's broken up. So guess what? After about 12 months, 14 probably, we were on the road with the Benson and Hedges sponsorship, and that was the making of the band because we could tour not only all over Australia, but New Zealand, and also Indonesia, Hong Kong, Russia, Latvia, Lithuania, Los Angeles, Hollywood, you know.
You mentioned 30-odd shows across the 3 years for that, in that first period, being quite a few, and you're obviously practicing quite a bit. But I imagine when you've got a band that's touring, doing the kind of touring you've just mentioned, you really begin to hit your straps then, don't you?
Absolutely. We did 58 concerts in that first 3 years, but a lot of rehearsals, as you said. But once we got on the road, night after night, like the American bands, you start to develop what we call iron chops, meaning the trumpet players can keep their lip in like it's, you know, very well-developed and strong. And same with me on drums. I mean, it's a very physical affair playing drums at that level in terms of volume and speed. Harold Jones, the drummer with Basie, I met him when he first joined the band in the Riverboat in the Empire State Building, Christmas Eve, 1967. And I said, how you going? Oh, it's my first night. And I'll digress just quickly. I said, what's it like with the charts? He said, there are none. I don't know who got rid of him, maybe Sonny Payne. But I saw him 3 or 4 years later and met up with him when the count came out here, I think 70, 71, that's right. And I went back to the hotel and had a chat with him. And he said, you know, I had to give up smoking to keep up with the band, you know. That's how physical it is for drums. But really, the brass players really cop it too. So we used to notice when we had one night off when we were on the road, that next concert back was tough because we developed such a high level of dynamics and volume and also softness that you had to have yourself right on song, you know.
And was it profitable, Warren, from quite apart from the sponsorship, to keep a band moving through that many countries for that period of time?
Well, let's address the concert platforms of Australia. We used to fill the Opera House 3 and 4 times over, and that meant we were pulling 10,800 people. Melbourne, we would pull 2 or 3 at Dallas Brooks or the Concert Hall. Adelaide, we'd always pull 2 in the Adelaide Festival Theatre. And we would be doing all the provincials as well, Wollongong, Newcastle, and we did, sorry about the same number again, but something like 58 concerts in one tour straight across Australia. And to answer your question, the concert halls and the majors were very profitable for us.
Right.
The provincials, you're always having, what's the word, the sponsorship top up because you just couldn't get the numbers given the high cost of travelling. We used to be the first really outfit to go from Darwin down to, you know, Alice Springs, Coober Pedy, you know, and we used to go down and fock a friendships, and the cost of taking 23 people, because that was with crew, was enormous, you know. But we wanted to get it out there. And years later, I went there for a commercial for the centenary, and it was a celebration of a nation, and we were all standing on Ayers Rock acting out, you know, various personalities that were known in various parts of showbiz and the like. And I don't know if you remember that commercial, but people were at the airport saying, "Warren, when are you going to bring the band back?" I was astounded. You know, I really was. But that meant quite a lot to them, because in those days, a lot of people avoided doing just what we did, you know. But New Zealand, we were greatly received in the capital, in the major cities, the provincial areas, as I said, same with Australia. But the Russians, when we went to Russia, you know, we had 4,000 and 5,000 people a night. Really? And it was to their profitability that that happened. In those days, they were selling tickets over there that people would have a month's wages to pay for. You know, and I mean, you can quote dollars and rubles these days, and you think, well, that's not very much. But you have to go back as to what the buying power and what people were paid, you know.
And they were going based on the fact that they'd heard of the band?
Yes. Look, let me say that they were starved of Western music, and they knew that our band, and no doubt the Russian people, played our records to them to get them there too. But the first thing the Russians said when they selected us amongst others put forward by Michael Edgeley and Kevin Jacobson, they said, "We take the big band, but we want their hair cut." Because we all had long hair. And I think it was Kevin said, "No, they don't cut their hair. You either take them as they are or that's it." And so we went over there, and we had such a marvellous time. You know, they went bananas because they loved the Beatles, and we did the Beatles medley. And when we did Jesus Christ Superstar, I have live tapes of this where the whole building just erupts. And for us, the slow clap is the kiss of death. Their slow clap is do not go. Keep playing, you know. They were just wonderful people, really. They were so warm. I would think, in a way, some of the most demonstrative audiences we've ever played for.
There you have it, our chat with Warren Daly from the Daly Wilson Big Band, the Ramblers, and of course the Steeds, and many, many other great Australian musical acts over the decades. Thanks very much to everyone who's listened to Recollections this year. Thanks to all you who've sent us letters, emails, text messages, tweets. We appreciate you getting in touch. We appreciate you being part of the program. And if you're listening to local radio, on New Year's Day at 12 o'clock, there'll be a special edition of Recollections on your radio. We'll be playing some extra tracks from some of the Recollections that we've done over the last 12 months or so. We've had a lot of correspondence. People have suggested other songs that we could have included. So we'll be rolling out some of those favourites at 12 o'clock on New Year's Day. So that's it for Recollections for this year. We'll talk to you next year.
Thanks for listening to this 666 ABC Canberra podcast. To subscribe to this or any of our podcasts, go to abc.net.au/Canberra.